You're listening to the Politics in Action Report at CJMQ 88.9 FM. I'm bringing you up to speed with the current political news. On this week's segment, I'll be discussing the latest on the political front, which includes Quebec passing its official marijuana bill, a run through what political parties are up to during the 2018 Quebec electoral campaign, the results of the Ontario election, the latest statistics for the unemployment rate in Canada, Andrew Scheer removes Maxime Bernier from his shadow cabinet, and the implications of the G7 summit. In recent news, the Quebec government has passed a marijuana legislation with 61 in favor and 46 members of Assemblée Nationale in opposition. Bill 157 establishes the legal framework for Quebec to produce, sell, and permit the consumption of marijuana. This bill is passed way ahead of the expected date for the legalization of marijuana in Canada as a whole. At the federal level, the marijuana bill continues to float in the Senate, with estimations that the bill will be passed at the end of summer. Turning our heads to our own upcoming provincial election, here is a look at what is occurring within each party's campaign. Mostly, we have debating occurring with the party's candidates. So let's look at a couple of examples, and I'll give you the run-through on what it means for Quebecers. First, we have Marwa Rizki for the Quebec Liberals and Catherine Fournier for the Parti Québécois pitted together debating the issue of immigration. Fournier accused the Liberals of only helping to integrate newcoming immigrants for the reason they want their votes. Rizki assures the current threshold of immigrants will be maintained, in opposition to the other parties desiring to decrease set threshold. So what is meant by threshold, in this case, is the amount of immigrants and asylum seekers Quebec decides to accept. What makes this topic increasingly debatable in Quebec is the fact that we have the problem with our aging population, while at the same time, the acceptance of all immigrants, including non-French immigrants, infringes on Quebec values. These are both arguments for each case, but this is one of the current issues the province has to deal with, given the large influx of migrants coming through the Quebec border to Canada. And so this is going to divide many Quebecers when it comes down to voting. It will come down to voting between the party that has a solution to the province's aging population, or the party that will protect the French Quebec identity. While we have the Quebec Liberals and the PQ in one corner, meanwhile, the PQ has expressed opposition to the CAQ's policy on privatization of the Quebec alcohol industry. The privatization of the alcohol industry would permit for private companies to control and manage the production and costs of alcohol, which would mean a greater variety of alcohol products sold to Quebecers at a lower price. This would be a new way of running the alcohol industry, directing away from the SAQ's monopoly of the industry. Why the PQ is in opposition to this policy initiative is because they affirm that this will not be beneficial to Quebecers, but rather that the SAQ's alcohol is already competitive at the current prices, and considering Quebec alcohol prices are cheaper than Ontario's alcohol prices. As you know, the alcohol industry generates a lot of revenue, and the CAQ is looking for ways to expand the industry and perhaps generate greater economic growth as well. The PQ stance is more like, don't fix it if it is not broken, and is looking more at protecting the benefits of a monopolistic industry. And so for voters, it will come down to maintaining the SAQ as it is, or revising the industry to potentially improve it. So as of now, I know a lot of the campaign sounds a lot like arguing back and forth on who has the best policies, but that is what is expected during the election campaign period. It's who has the best arguments that will ultimately sway the Quebec population to support one party over another. In covering this next story, I assume Canadians were watching the live stream coverage of the Ontario provincial election, because I was one of them. The stream was broadcasted from CTV, which began 9 o'clock Eastern Time, and in not even 15 minutes later, they declared Doug Ford's victory with a majority government. To obtain a majority government, the party had to acquire 64 out of the 124 seats represented by ridings. In total, the Conservative Party cashed in on 76 seats, an overwhelming amount, but definitely not the most a party has achieved historically. According to CTV, in 1929, the PCs had won a majority government with 90 seats against Ontario's Liberals. From the historical charts, we can interpret the results as depicting that for most of Ontario's electoral history, that the PCs had been the most popular party among Ontarians. So what is to be expected now that the province has a new premier? You can expect that most initiatives that Premier Kathleen Wynne had put forward during her time in office will be abolished or undone by Doug Ford. So this includes canceling the proposed $15 an hour minimum wage hike that was scheduled for the next year. Some interesting facts about the Ontario election. As you know, this election has made history with several outcomes. First, I will discuss an interesting fact and something that has made history is the fact that this election saw the youngest candidate to be elected into the provincial legislature. Sam Osterhoff was elected in the riding of Niagara West, winning by a large margin of approximately 11,000 votes, with over 24,000 votes casted for him. The 19-year-old represents the Ontario Conservative Party and is not only happy to be representing the Ontario Conservatives, but as well to be representing the youth demographic. Secondly, I think it is also interesting that Jagmeet Singh's brother, Gurritan Singh, secured his riding in Brampton East by accumulating 47% of the votes in his riding. It tells you that the majority of voters in this riding either wanted an NDP representative, or they wanted a representative who represented the multicultural nature of the riding, and in Canada as a whole. Gurritan Singh, in his acceptance speech, said he was honored to have been selected as representative for Brampton East. So it's interesting to see in this case how politics runs in the family. Thirdly, in making history in this provincial election, the Green Party had secured its first seat in the riding of Guelph, Ontario, by electing Mike Schreiner into the provincial legislature. We will definitely see Schreiner give Premier Ford a tough time when it comes to dealing with matters of environmental protection and climate change. What comes to mind when I see this outcome is that it is reflective of the federal election, where Elizabeth May has the only Green Party seat in the House of Commons, representing Saanich Gulf Islands in BC. Although she remains the only voice for the Green Party in the House of Commons, her voice is pretty loud in representing her party's interest. To that effect, I can see the same occur for Queen's Park, most definitely with fewer members in the provincial legislature when compared to the 300-some-odd members of the House of Commons. I think one of the main components of this election was the fact that there was sort of a fatigue and a desire for change on behalf of Ontarians, with the Liberal Party being in power for at least 15 years. So there was this immense desire to switch to the other party, which ultimately led to Doug Ford's victory. It also helped for Doug Ford to campaign on hopes and dreams, which is something Ontarians longed for, after 4 years of the disappointing performance of Premier Wynne. This definitely was the most interesting provincial election Ontario has seen in years. It started rough enough, with the resignation of the Ontario PC's leader Patrick Brown and the swift process of finding a replacement. I think what made this election interesting was the fact that the PCs had a leader they offered that was quite controversial, and there was a great fight to prevent this controversial politician from getting into the Premier's office. So it was like an electoral battle between one side fighting for political change and the other fighting for anything other than Doug Ford. One of Canada's goals, as well as individual provinces' goals, involves reducing the unemployment rate. And this is in considering unemployment cannot be wholly eliminated, there is the standard natural rate of unemployment. But even so, keeping the national rate of unemployment at a minimum level is appreciated. The Montreal Gazette has posted the latest monthly statistics of unemployment by province and compares the monthly rates to the previous months. So the statistics depict the May statistical ratings in comparison to the month of April. According to said stats, the following provinces saw a drop in unemployment rates, which is beneficial: PEI, New Brunswick, Quebec, and BC, while the remaining provinces either had the same unemployment rates or higher unemployment rates. Based on my understanding of the provinces, I will attempt to explain the rates of unemployment for each province. For PEI, PEI has been performing relatively well in terms of GDP, so we can see that it has maintained its momentum, and employment rates, while not directly associated with the growth in GDP, does significantly contribute to the provincial GDP because we have more hands producing goods, and so therefore the province is producing more, and when the province produces more than it imports, then it's going to have a greater GDP. So all this to explain that I see this correlation between its relatively high GDP and the reduction of its unemployment rate. As for New Brunswick, it is quite a surprise for myself, given unemployment is typically higher in the maritime provinces. But I believe its reduction to unemployment may be due to seasonal changes. Fishing and employment typically associated with the ocean necessitates for more workers. So when the time comes when it's summer, it's warm, and they need more employees to be out on the ocean waters, then that reduces the unemployment rate. I cannot say for sure the reasons because I'm not an economist, so this is all based purely on my observation and the facts that I know about these provinces. Now let's look at the other side of the coin. What about the provinces that saw no reduction in their unemployment rates? For Ontario, the reason is obvious. With the hike of minimum wage from $11 to $14 an hour this year, Ontario companies don't have the financial means to hire more workers. I also believe companies are adjusting to this wage hike, and it is with reason why there wasn't any reduction to the provincial unemployment rate. We've looked at a province with obvious reasons why the unemployment rate has not been reduced. Now for the not so obvious, let's look at the province of Alberta. Alberta is often associated as the province where there's several employment opportunities, and it's where much of the youth from central Canada goes to find employment. So why has Alberta not been able to reduce its unemployment rate? One of the reasons as to why it has not reduced its unemployment rate, I affirm, is because of the economic crisis it had back in, I want to say 2016, but don't quote me. Considering the economic crisis occurred a few years ago, it does not give the economy much time to heal and recover, so it is likely still recovering from the crises, and it's going to take some time for it to recover and get back to its optimal level. And likewise, when an economy is performing poorly, there's not much room for companies to hire any other employees. Not to mention the fact that Alberta enjoys a higher income, with income higher than the national average. Albertans earn, on average, $94,000 annually, while the national average sits at $74,000 annually. So given the wages are higher in Alberta, and they are recovering from an economic crisis, there isn't much room to deal with problems such as unemployment. And I believe that's how we see it reflecting in these recent statistics. Overall, 4 out of the 10 provinces has seen a reduction in unemployment rates. As I previously stated, the objective is to reduce the amount of unemployment as much as possible in considering the natural rate of unemployment, because there is always going to be that natural rate of unemployment that's just not going to go away. So provinces have to reduce it the best they can. I'm not certain where the future of employment's going to go in the near future. Even more so, with Trump applying tariffs on Canadian aluminum and steel, We will have to find out in the next coming months. Recent reports state that Andrew Scheer, leader of the Progressive Conservative Party of Canada, has removed his fellow party affiliate, Maxime Bernier, from what is called the Shadow Cabinet, shadowing current standing cabinet ministers on the Liberal front. Maxime Bernier was shadowing for the Minister of Science and Innovation and Economic Development, Navdeep Bains. What this move essentially means is that he is basically no longer one of the best buddies of Scheer, who could have expected to have been appointed into cabinet should the Conservatives win the next federal election. While there are no explanations provided for this course of action, I do have some theories of my own. One theory, as this was indeed a political strategy. Because Bernier is the poster boy popular Tory, there is the chance he would outshine Scheer as a Conservative, even if he was only a cabinet minister under Scheer. Many were astounded when Scheer won the leadership back in 2017, because Bernier seemed like the obvious choice. As a result, Scheer wants to be the shining star and wouldn't want his leadership to be outshined by the members below him. My second theory that I will offer is that Scheer and Bernier are direct competitors and they share different views. Recall during the Conservative leadership race, both Scheer and Bernier were scavenging votes in Quebec, Bernier's home province, and a location that was beneficial for Scheer to pick up the votes left from opposition to Bernier's criticism of Canada's dairy supply management, essentially Quebec dairy farmers. So Scheer swooped in and got the Quebec dairy farmers to vote for him. So from the start, these two politicians were rivals, and you find any opportunity to get rid of your rival. Bernier presented this opportunity by publishing his latest book and claiming that Scheer had fake conservatives to vote for him, and this accounted for his leadership victory. It does sound like Andrew Scheer wants to run a direct campaign, which essentially means his campaign will have the same message and nothing will blur these lines, not even a distinct voice from his own. So, do I necessarily think this move was smart? I honestly don't think so, for the reason that Bernier, while controversial for his dairy supply management position, is still quite popular in the province of Quebec. It is certain that with his popularity and his former experience as Minister of Foreign Affairs under Prime Minister Stephen Harper, this would make him the ideal candidate in the minds of Canadians to have been selected as a cabinet minister. While it is valid to say that those that butt heads on given issues won't necessarily get along, I believe it is beneficial to have people on your team that have conflicting views on given issues. And this is due to the fact that these opposing views will appeal to some people maybe the others haven't appealed to, but as well demonstrate that all members of elected office don't all think the same. So this is a sense of independent thinking and the functions of a democracy, where everyone's voice means something. But Scheer's reasoning is that there will be no ambiguity and the Conservatives will campaign with one straightforward message that is easy for voters to comprehend. In Scheer's mind, Bernier is still perceived as competition, and it was only a matter of time before Bernier would be removed from his inner circle. The next thing I'll be discussing in the political news is the G7 summit and the conversation revolving around the G7 summit. So, I just want to start off with contextualizing what the G7 summit is for those who don't know or if this is the first time you're hearing about the G7 summit. So, the G7 is a group of seven economically advanced countries that convene and establish trends revolving around global issues. So, the group of seven consists of Canada, the United States, Germany, France, Japan, Italy, and the United Kingdom. To provide some historical background to the G7, it is a group that originated in the 1970s and put forward by the French government, who held a meeting regarding the oil crisis of the 70s. The French president at the time, Giscard d'Estaing, invited neighboring countries such as Germany, Italy, the UK, along with Japan and the US, in order to develop resolutions for the oil crisis. Over time, this group of six, along with the addition of Canada in 1976, as well as representatives for the EU, began to meet annually to discuss and deliberate the leading global issues. So, at these summits, it is extremely relevant to set an example for all the spectator countries, countries that don't attend, but watch and take example from these leading countries. This year, Canada hosted the G7 summit, which was held in Charlevoix, Quebec, this past weekend. The major issues put on the discussion table included gender equality and women's empowerment, investing in growth, climate change, discussing future jobs, and ensuring a peaceful and secure world. An event that was designated for all these issues was more about diplomatic tensions between countries and the US. One picture taken by Jesco Denzel demonstrates this. All G7 leaders are standing around the table at which President Trump is sitting, and this shows a standoff between 6-1. The meeting had begun without Trump, who turned up sometime after the meeting commenced during talks of gender equality. If any of you watch the video, you can see French President Emmanuel Macron give him a wave in greeting, which represents his hope for a decent conversation with the tardy president. Whether his tardiness was due to his reluctance to see his trade partners or his reluctance to attend the summit altogether, because as a matter of fact, he skipped the White House Correspondents' Dinner to attend a rally of his supporters instead. There are a few factors that demonstrate the severed ties with the six member countries to the United States. Aside from showing up late to the G7 discussions, Trump as well left the summit early prior to the discussions on climate change. This partly due to the fact that Trump does not believe in climate change. Trump took his time instead to take to Twitter and attack Prime Minister Justin Trudeau in saying he was dishonest and weak, this coming from a 70-year-old grown man hiding behind his Twitter account. This was in regard to the current trade dispute between Canada and the US. His rage was likely sparked by the fact that everyone seems to be defending Canada. Even US economists have seen the reasonable perspective of Canada, which tipped Trump over the edge. Then lastly, Trump announced he would not honor the G7's collective communique he had just signed. The collective communique essentially lays out the collective agreements on the summit's issues that the countries will fulfill in order to achieve these goals. For example, in order to ensure a secure and peaceful world, the countries have all agreed to denounce and call for the denuclearization of North Korea. So Trump isn't honoring his role as president and filling in former president's shoes in maintaining harmonious relations with ally countries and honoring commitments. What I could say is that things could have been handled a lot more professionally at the summit. In terms of the news coverage, I wish I heard more about the progress that was made during the summit rather than the current disputes among the member countries. I couldn't actually believe we would come to this point, but Canada is in the process of enacting Plan B in terms of the whole NAFTA ordeal. I will provide an update on what exactly is Canada's Plan B at a later date. Do I wish things would have been handled more professionally? Yes, as I said before. But is this a realistic wish? Not exactly, given the current circumstances and the current standing president. Maybe by next year's G7, he would have learned his lesson. And that lesson would be not adding fuel to the fire every opportunity you get, and focus on things that actually matter. That is it for this segment's Politics in Action report. I hope you will tune in the next time. I'm Emily with CJMQ 88.9 FM.